Hey, when we talk about the pioneers or precursors or the prehistory of free market thought, the two names that usually loom largest are John Locke and Adam Smith. So I'm not going to talk about either of them today because you're likely already to have encountered quite a bit by or about them, or if you haven't, you're likely to do so in the future. So I want to talk about some people who are less known, but who I think deserve our attention. I think these might be particularly interesting for people who are in either philosophy or political science. I know that the discipline of economics outside of Austrian circles tends not to stress history of thought that much, but I think that there's also possible work to be done within economics and some of these guys too. So I'm going to start. Where people hardly ever start, with ancient China, and within ancient China, I'm going to start with the people that people looking for precursors of free market thought rarely start with, which is the Confucians. Usually, if anyone starts looking in China for precursors of libertarian thought, they look at the Taoists. But I think the Confucians have an interesting claim on us. Now, one reason that people tend to suggest the Taoists is because you find in Taoist thought an emphasis on spontaneous order and the idea that governments tend to mess things up through intervention and that society has its own natural order and will run by itself if government doesn't interfere too much, which the Taoists do say. However, many of the Confucians say that too. Generally, it's thought that they just cribbed it from the Taoists because of the traditional assumption that Lao Tzu lived in the 6th or 7th century BC, which would make him earlier than any of the Confucians. But modern scholars mostly think, although it's still a matter of dispute, but mostly they think that whether or not there was someone named Lao Tzu who lived back then, the work we have, the Tao Te Ching that's attributed to him, is probably no later, probably no earlier than the 4th century, which means that Confucianism was already in place when that text came about. And so it may have been the Confucians rather than the Taoists who originated the idea of spontaneous order. Now, again, it's hard to know because even if the text, if Taoist texts we have are later, Lao Tzu may have been an earlier thinker and he may have inspired some of these ideas, so who knows. Although the Taoists do describe an explicitly anarchist society, or at least Lao Tzu seems to, and Bao Zhenyan certainly does, more so than the Confucians. Nevertheless, from the standpoint of traditional free market thought, the Taoist version of free market anarchism has a disadvantage, which is it tends to be of a primitivist variety. That is to say, the free market, the anarchistic utopia that they picture is one where there's no interaction between one village and another. You can hear the dogs barking and the cow and the cocks crowing in the next village, but you never actually go over there to see them. There's no trade between villages. And everyone lives a life of great simplicity, and the art of writing is forgotten. People keep records only by tying knots in ropes to count things. So this is not a world of advanced civilization. It's not a world of trade and exchange, and maybe there's some kind of trade exchange going on within the village, but there's no trade between villages, which means that from a libertarian standpoint, it's not what most of us would like. Whereas the Confucians were, at least the early Confucians, before they became the official state bureaucracy and, needless to say, lost a lot of what libertarian edge they had, But the Confucians, early Confucians, are big fans of trade. Later on, they stopped being so. But early on, they were big fans of trade. They stressed the idea of mutual gains from trade. In other words, they recognized that when there's trade, it's not the case that there has to be a winner and a loser in the trade, that both sides are better off. And they talk about how wonderful trade is and how it brings things from all over the world and how it's all done without any central direction. It says, you know, this wonderful automatic flow whereby goods flow from where they're produced to where they're needed. And they also sing the praises of entrepreneurship. The Chinese historian Sima Qian may be the Google's clearest example of this. I mean, when Sima Qian starts talking about entrepreneurs, it sounds like a cross between Israel Kirzner and Ayn Rand and the extent to which he praises them. The Confucians also clearly grasp the idea of marginal utility. They said even though I, you know, prefer good X to good Y, in general, I would prefer a particular quantity of Y to a particular quantity of X in given circumstances. So they're already well on their way to seeing around the diamond water paradox. They also had this idea of jurisdictional competition. They thought they were giving advice to various local rulers because the Chinese philosophy emerges in the breakdown of the previous dynasty, which had ruled what they called at the time all of China, though all of China was a much smaller region than China is today. And the old empire broke up into all these little states, and then these former now displaced bureaucrats and middle managers and teachers and so forth would travel around to these different states and try and give advice to the local rulers. And what the Confucian stressed is that the rulers should recognize that they have an incentive to promote good policies in order to lure customers, as it were, away from neighboring states. So they saw different local states as competing and they thought it was a good thing that they would compete to have the best policies. Competition would produce the best policies. Now, of course, on the downside, they thought that once all the states had been competed into producing the best policies, they could all unite into a single nationwide monopoly, and you wouldn't need competition anymore in the future, which seems to be a bit short-sighted on their part. But they were also, in many ways, very good critics of state power. You see them talking about the problems with price controls, how it causes shortages, how it gives perverse incentives. They are critics of taxation. So there's a lot of good stuff in the early Confucians. Okay, moving over to ancient Greece. The early Greek philosophers were not especially free market oriented in the content of their thought, although we'll see that there's some particular points in which they might have been. I think that in the structure of their thought, they are pioneers of praxeology. Now, they weren't using praxeology primarily as a means of developing insights into economics. Their primary interests are ethical, and they are interested in developing a theory of virtuous action and the human good. But in that context, and beginning mainly with Socrates, at least, to the extent that we can infer his views from what his disciples say, start getting essentially a conceptual analysis of human action as a way of developing the foundations of an ethical theory. So with the Greek philosophers, we start with the idea that all action aims at an end, that action is the application of means to achievement of ends, and they have the idea of orders of goods, the idea that some goals are means to achieve yet further goals, which are means to achieve yet further goals. But there are some goods, what the Austrians would call goods of highest order, which are goods valued for themselves and not for the sake of producing something further. And they have the idea of the imputation of value, the idea that the value of the means derives from and depends on the value of the end. And so that when you have a whole chain of means, the whole chain gets its value from the final end. And they also were subjectivists about value, not in the ethical sense, because they thought that some ends were genuinely objectively right and others wrong, but they were subjectivists in the explanatory sense that matters for economics. That is, they thought that in order to explain human action, you had to appeal to the desires and values and perspective of the person in question, and that you couldn't talk of something as as having value apart from some relation to some human end. And that's something that runs through all the Greek philosophers. You'll see on the list I include Cicero and Lucretius, you might think are not strictly Greek philosophers, but since 90% of their work is the development of ideas they got from Greek philosophers, I think we can treat them as being in that tradition. Now, in addition to that, although on the whole their political theories are not especially market-oriented, we can also find some market ideas in them. We can even find market ideas in the place where you might least expect to find them, namely in Plato's Republic, which does not seem like a free market utopia, since it, we have a this essentially totalitarian state. You get the attack on private property, so you wouldn't expect to find libertarian insights there. But there are some. In particular, early on in the second book of the Republic, Plato raises the question of what do you need? What do you need for a society? And he starts talking about, well, you need someone to do this task and someone to do that task. You need someone to grow the food and someone to cook the food and so forth. And he just sets out the division of labor. And then he stops and says, all right, now we've got everything we need for a city. And he said nothing about government. He's just to set out the city of a bunch of people, producing goods and services for one another. And he said, well, that's all you need. But then the question comes up, what if people aren't satisfied with this? What if they want, what if the city wants to expand its territory and so forth? Well, then it's going to come into conflict with other cities. There's going to be war. And so now you're going to need a class of soldiers. And he says, well, that seems like a bad idea. Wouldn't it be better just to stick with this little, society we've got? He says, well, human nature being what it is, probably we can't stick with that. So they're going to be greedy and inquisitive, and they're going to get into quarrels with their neighbors. So they're going to need a military class. And pretty soon he's got the whole society structured as a kind of military. The whole society becomes a kind of military camp run from the top down, except the people at the top are the philosophers who they don't need. They're free from this acquisitiveness and so forth, but the common people aren't. And so as a result of that, we end up with this authoritarian state. But the authoritarian state is the second best in Plato. The ideal was it was a free market anarchy. It's just that it was a fairly, maybe not quite as primitivist as the Taoists, but fairly primitive level. And he thought that human nature couldn't stand that and would want more, and therefore wouldn't ultimately be viable. We also get in two dialogues, which may not be by Plato, but they are, at any rate, by early Platonists, if not by Plato, the Hipparchus and the Eryxias, we get an analysis of wealth and profit. And in the Hipparchus, the question is raised, what do we say about a profit lover? A profit lover was a pejorative term in Greek. And Socrates says, well, what do you mean by a profit lover? If by a profit lover you mean someone who, prefers to gain rather than lose in transactions, or prefers to get more out of something than they put into it, then anyone in the right mind is a profit lover. And if instead you mean that a profit lover is someone who seeks profit from wicked things, well, then he goes into his psychological theory, according to which no one consciously values evil. They always value evil through some kind of ignorance. So in one sense, everyone's a profit lover. In another sense, no one's a profit lover. In the course of that, he raises the question, what counts as a profit? And someone says, well, a profit is when you get more back in exchange for what you gave. And Socrates says, well, You know, so I'll give you, I'll translate his answer into our currency. Suppose I give you a $20 bill and you give me three $1 bills back. So I gave you one thing, I got back three things. Have I made a profit? No, because it's not the material quantity involved, it's the value. It's because I value the $20 more than the $3 that that wouldn't be a profit. And likewise, in the Aruxius, we get this account of how true wealth depends not on material quantities, but on the value, the use you can make of it. And in the Minos, we give it an account of law, according to which the government does not produce law. The government has no power of its own to produce law. Law is determined by the nature of human beings and what ways of living work and what ones don't. And then all governments can do is come along after the fact and declare things laws, and they can get it right or they can get it wrong. Some of these ideas also show up in Xenophon. The idea that the idea of the division of labor, the idea that that wealth is based on value, this idea of legal naturalism. Then Aristotle, of course, we get the famous defense of private property. It is, in effect, a kind of anticipation of the tragedy of the commons argument, the argument that if everything is common, there's likely to be insufficient incentive to take care of anything. So it's an incentive argument, not a knowledge argument, but not a calculation argument, but you can't have everything. In Cicero, we get this very Hayekian argument that the reason the Roman Constitution works, of course, you wonder whether the Roman Constitution works is really a true statement, but he says the reason the Roman Constitution works is because it wasn't the product of any one individual mind. Instead, it grew gradually through an evolutionary trial and error process. And Lucretius on the Nature of Things makes fun of the idea that language was invented by some wise ruler, and says no, social phenomena generally emerge by trial and error and by evolution. Well, given the praxeological framework in which Greek ethics was conducted, I think it's no surprise that the emergence of something like proto-Austrian economics comes out of that tradition. As you find in the medieval scholastics, these are people who were deeply influenced by Greek philosophy. They had reformulated it into a Christian context, and so they changed various things in the course of Christianizing it. But they had nevertheless drew deeply on the Platonic and Aristotelian and Stoic ideas. And so all those praxeological assumptions about relationship between means and ends and subjective value being explaining of action and all that stuff, they then started applying it systematically to economics. Whereas the ancient Greeks hadn't said that much about economics, and what they said was a mixed bag. But the medievals inherited that framework, and then they started developing very sophisticated and in some ways very similar to Austrian theories of economics. Now, the medievals tend to have a poor reputation for their economic views. They're widely thought of as being very anti-commerce, anti-trade, which is a bad reputation, not in all circles, but at least in ours. But this is really inaccurate. I mean, there's a common view that the medieval philosophers all believed that it was wrong to charge anything but the natural or just price, and that the natural or just price was something to be determined by some sort of philosophical speculation, not by the market. But that's not really accurate. Now, it's true that most of these guys were against the charging of interest. This was taken to be one of the requirements of Christianity, and so they had to work within that framework. But nevertheless, on the whole, their conception of the just price was the market price, that the market was what determined the just prize, with some qualifications that they would, you know, that they would add. But on the whole, they were very much in favor of those prices that emerged from the market. They developed a fairly sophisticated monetary theory. They were strongly opposed to government interference with currency. They were, you know, in many ways, proto-Austrians, which is why in Rothbard's History of Economic Thought, he, you know, spends a fair bit of time on them, and that's one of the sources I cite here. Okay, jumping forward a bit, talking about England in the 17th through 19th centuries. You know, this is the period that is, you know, that in most histories is dominated by John Locke and Adam Smith, and in many ways rightly so. But the there were other people too, including people earlier than Locke. For example, the Levellers, a group who always disliked the term Levellers, but they're called that because they never chose another name for themselves. They would even write pamphlets saying, "From those falsely called Levellers." Well, I mean, if you're gonna, if your name for your band is "Those Falsely Called Levellers," you're stuck with the name Levellers forever. You know, it's like the artist formerly known as Prince. I mean, you know, you're not gonna call him. You know, he doesn't offer another name. He's stuck with that one. There were other groups who were opposed to private property, or at least to private property in land, and they called themselves true levelers. But historians won't call them levelers. Historians call them diggers. So these guys who didn't want to be called levelers are called the levelers. And these other groups who wanted to be called the levelers get called the diggers, because there's no justice. But anyway, they were... these guys were broadly similar to Locke in a lot of their views, but they tended to be, you know, more radical. They were involved in the English Civil War. They'd been on the side of Parliament against the king, but once Cromwell took over, they were against him too. They kept getting thrown into the prisons by both sides. Richard, one of the Richard Overton has what I think may be my favorite title for any political. Any work in political thought. And this isn't even the whole title, but this is sort of the core of it. "An arrow against all tyrants and tyranny shot from Newgate Prison into the prerogative bowels of the arbitrary House of Lords and all other usurpers and tyrants whatsoever." Now, that's not my absolute favorite title for any work. This is my favorite title for a political work. My favorite title for any work, or at least for any philosophical work, is Christian Wolff's "Rational Thoughts on God, the World, and the Soul of Man, and also all things in general." They had good titles in those days. Actually, we seem to be going back to that tradition of having publishers having these long subtitles, though I think generally less amusing. In the 18th century, we get the pamphleteers John Trenchard and Thomas Gordon, who write these things called Cato's Letters. And actually, the Cato Institute gets its name from letters, not from the, you know, not directly from the Roman senator. The reason they picked Cato, it was very popular and common for people in the 18th century to use Cato as a as a symbol or as a pseudonym. Because Cato was the great, you know, was the great fighter against Julius Caesar and against the rise of the Roman Empire. Not that Cato himself would have been a terribly libertarian figure, really, but he was seen as sort of resistance to imperial pretensions. And they wrote these very influential pamphlets that the modern academic establishment has declared are not really classical liberal. They're really civic republican, because classical liberals are in favor of wealth, and civic republicans think wealth is a corrupting factor, and they keep talking about wealth as a corrupting factor, so they can't really be classical liberals. This is imposing a very narrow set of categories on these guys. They were very upset about the corrupting effect of wealth on government and on the influence of special interests on government. because it tended to drive government power to do bad things, like, you know, interfering with liberty. So whether or not they count as civic Republicans, and I'm happy to say, sure, they do. It's a very amorphous concept. Lots of different ways of being civic Republicans. But they certainly were clearly, you know, pro-free market classical liberals. And they were a big influence on the American Revolution. In the 19th century, we get Thomas Hodgkin. This is a guy that I think, you know, contemporary academia also tends to miscategorize. He's usually described as a Ricardian socialist. Well, he was influenced by Ricardo, but he was also influenced by Smith, influenced by Locke, and various different people. He wasn't especially Ricardian. And he was a socialist only in the sense that, you know, in the fight between labor and capital, he was, you know, he thought of himself as being on the side of labor. But he was strongly a defender of private property and free markets. Like, he criticized Herbert Spencer for not being a big enough fan of private property. So the term Ricardian socialist is deeply unhelpful label for him. Part of the reason he's been given that label is because he's seen as being an influence on Marx because Marx quotes him. But if you look at the passages where Marx quotes him, Marx has no idea, has completely misinterpreting what Hodgkin is saying. He makes various points that he thinks are telling points against Hodgkin without realizing that Hodgkin is already, you know, five steps ahead of him on the very same point. What Hodgkin does is he takes Locke's theory of property and then argues that this is not a thesis for defending existing property relations as they existed in England, but actually for criticizing them. Because he says, you know, existing property titles actually run back to various kinds of government privilege and expropriation and not from homesteading and free exchange, then then far from the usual view where Locke was embraced by conservatives and attacked by socialists on the assumption that he is a spokesman for existing property relations, Hodgkin says, no, on the contrary, the existing distribution of property is condemned by Lockean considerations. He says you have to distinguish between property that's the result of homesteading and free exchange, which he calls natural property, and property that's the result of government privilege, which he calls artificial property. This is too nuanced a view for a lot of contemporary historians of thought. And so they say, oh, he's attacking the property classes, so socialist, therefore he must be anti-free market, no matter how many pages he spends going on and on about the virtues of the free market. Next, I'm going to talk a bit about French liberalism. Start a little earlier than the main line of French liberalism with Étienne de la Boétie. And if you know French, you probably think I'm mispronouncing that, but in contemporary French, it would be de la Boétie. But apparently it's thought that in his era and in the particular part of France he lived in, that would have been pronounced de la Boétie. Anyway, he writes, or probably writes, there's some dispute as to the actual authorship, but anyway, his is the name on the famous work called The Discourse on Voluntary Servitude, where he points out that rulers are vastly outnumbered by those they rule. And that as a consequence, it can't really be true that rulers maintain their power solely by force, because the rulers are too few. They're just, you know, a bunch of humans. It's not like they're from the planet Krypton or anything. And so therefore, they don't have enough might personally to impose their will on the population. And so the population must be acquiescing in the power system in order for it to maintain itself. And so he considers various questions about how this works. It's a combination of propaganda, where people become convinced that government has some kind of sacred status and that people should be bowing to it, and then also the various systems of patronage, where the top few buy off a larger group, which in turn buy off a larger group, which in turn buy off a larger group with progressively smaller bribes and privileges, so that everyone somehow is duped into thinking they have a stake in the system, when really it's only the few at the top that really get much out of it. And then he recommends a a strategy for overthrowing government, which is not by violent revolution. He thinks that's completely unnecessary, but just by withdrawing your consent. Now, of course, if only a few people withdraw their consent, then, you know, the government will come down on them. But if we get a sufficiently large critical mass of people just simply withdrawing their consent, not having to go and, you know, storm the Bastille or anything, but just simply refuse to cooperate, the state would fall of its own accord. Okay, then we get a line of early French economists. First, there's either Richard Cantillon or Richard Cantillon. He divided his time between Ireland and France, so we don't know exactly how he pronounced his name. This is one of Mark Thornton's favorite economists. He has written a lot about him and has gone through great effort to try and identify a painting as possibly being of him. Cantillon is earlier than Adam Smith, but he has an economic treatise that anticipates a lot of Smith, and he's sort of one of the originators of this French tradition that runs through Turgot and Condillac and so forth. And they're very strongly pro-free market. And also they are holders of a subjective theory of value, where the English school was primarily going for various versions of labor theory of value. The French school was developing a subjective theory of value. Condillac is one of the one of the first ones to talk about the double inequality of value, meaning that since in order for there to be an exchange, I have to value something more than you, and you have to value what you get more than I do, so that each of us benefits from the exchange. Therefore, the mere fact of an exchange produces wealth. That is, makes the society more wealthy because each has what they value more as a result of the exchange. This idea comes from Condillac. Then we get Jean-Baptiste Say, who nowadays is mainly famous just for Say's Law, but there's a lot more to him than that. Say thought of himself as a follower of Adam Smith, who'd written by this time, but Say nevertheless is drawing very much on this subjectivist tradition, whereas Smith is still trying to work out some version of a labor theory of value. And then we get a contemporary of, say, Destutt de Tracy, who some people have called the first libertarian. It's hard to know what counts as the first of anything. If you define it broadly enough, you can push it quite far back. If you define it narrowly enough, it gets more reasoned. But at any rate, he has a lot of things. He looks in many ways like a contemporary libertarian. He was also Thomas Jefferson's favorite economist. In fact, Jefferson translated Tracy's economic treatise. Tracy also wrote a commentary on Montesquieu, which basically consisted of taking all of Montesquieu's status deviations and turning them into radical libertarian stuff. And then there's Constant, who is less neglected than some of these other figures. In particular, Constant's work on the difference between ancient and modern liberty, where ancient liberty was primarily about political participation and not being, a city's not being governed by some other city, whereas modern liberty, which Constant thinks is more important, is about being free in your individual and private life. So liberty not as civic participation so much as being left alone. That's a fairly well-known piece. His other works are less well-known both within and without libertarian circles. And there's often a failure for people to recognize exactly how pro-laissez-faire he was, but he really was quite pro-laissez-faire. Then we get to one of the most interesting and really most tragically neglected groups, which was the Saint-Cyr group. The Saint-Cyr was a publication in early 19th century France, edited primarily by these three guys, Charles Comte, Charles Dunoyer, and Augustin Thierry. Charles Comte is, as far as I can tell, no relation to the more famous Auguste Comte. At any rate, John Stuart Mill writes a letter to Auguste Comte, which he talks about Charles Comte, and he refers to him as your homonym, and not, for example, your cousin or anything like that. So I'm guessing, so at least as far as Mill knew, they weren't related other than by name. In these works, they develop one of the earliest theories of libertarian class struggle, which is there are two classes in society. There's the class that gets its wealth primarily through government privilege and government expropriation on its behalf, versus the industrial class, which includes both businessmen and workers, and they make their wealth primarily through production and free exchange. And the state is the tool of the parasitic class primarily, the point of the class struggle is to suppress the state, to replace the administration, to replace the government of men with the administration of things. That's one of the phrases that they use. And they don't quite use the phrase "wither, the state will wither away," but they come very close. They never quite say that the state should cease to exist, but they say things like, you know, the state should be radically decentralized so that, you know, the world will be municipalized. You know, there'll be no political structure larger than a municipality. But they didn't mean there should be no social or economic interaction larger than a municipality. They weren't Taoists. They were very much in favor of free trade and free exchange and, on a global level. But they wanted political power to be devolved to the point of virtual non-existence. And the next to the names, I've also given some works they did, you know, that weren't part of the censor. You might wonder why libertarians would call their publication the censor. Well, the word censor in their era had come to acquire the new meaning that it has now, but still was flavored with the old meaning. And the old meaning of censor was someone who was looking into public virtue. And although that was a state role in ancient Rome, the connotation of it wasn't, the older connotation wasn't so much a state role, just anyone who's concerned with public virtue. And so this is a case where it was like a pun, because censor had now acquired the modern meaning, and their own works were frequently seized by the government censors. But they thought of themselves as being censors on the censors. That is, they thought of themselves as being public, guardians of the public virtue by criticizing government. So censor meant something almost like watchdog in their usage. Part of the sad thing about these very influential guys is that almost none of their works have been translated. You know, very little of the Saint-Cyr has been translated. The works they did separately, almost nothing's been translated, except some of Thierry's later works have been. But Thierry got less radical as he got older. So did Dunoyer. Comte didn't, but he died young, so we were spared that. Dunoyer had this huge treatise, and they kept going through edition after edition. Each edition, he'd make less radical but longer. And the longer stuff was often good. I mean, you know, there's interesting stuff. So which means there's no one edition of it you can say, well, that's the edition, forget the others, because the early editions are more radical. But the later, less radical ones still have some good stuff in them. These guys were really interesting and deserve more attention. Then I mentioned Bastiat here, but Bastiat is also, you know, less neglected than these other figures. Of course, he certainly is, you know, neglected. Even people who like him tend to think of him solely as a popularizer, and I really think he was more than that. But I'm not going to say a lot about him, because you've probably already encountered Bastiat, or are likely to if you hang out in libertarian or free market circles. So I'm not going to say much about him, except to say that Bastiat said that his chief inspiration was the Saint-Cyr group. Another interesting French liberal is Charles Coquelin, who had the idea of competing currencies. One person I didn't mention here, but probably should have, was Frederic Passy, P-A-S-S-Y. And he's a good person to know if you want to stump people with a trivia question. Who is the first libertarian economist to win a Nobel Prize? You know, which can cause interesting debates because you know, you can argue about you know, which ones were actually libertarian or whether any actual libertarian economist has ever won a Nobel Prize. But anyway, the reason it's a trick question is because people assume that it's a that it's the Nobel Prize in economics. In fact, Frederic Passy won the very first Nobel Peace Prize because he was a big anti-war activist. Then in this group, there's Gustave de Molinari, who is actually Belgian rather than French, and I bear his image on my tie. He was a kind of protege of Bastiat. He was also fan of the Saint-Cyr group. But he appears to have been the first, you know, people often say he's the first free market anarchist. Now, exactly how you know, being the first X is always tricky as a matter of exactly how you define things. Certainly, there had been free market people before him who had thought you could do away with the state. But they hadn't gone into much detail as to how the state's functions would be replaced. Molinari was the first person to talk about how the security function, in particular, protecting people's rights, either from crime or from foreign invasion, how you could do that with competing firms rather than a monopoly state. And although his proposal wasn't all that detailed, it was still you know, far more detailed than anything had been done before that. So he has some claim to be you know, the first free market anarchist. He's also he's someone very few of whose works have been translated. Although what's probably his major book, The Soirées on the Rue Saint-Lazare, has you know, has now finally been translated by Liberty Fund. Although they haven't released the print edition yet, the whole translation is now online. So that's good. His shorter work, The Production of Security, well, it's for sale in there and online everywhere. That's fairly widely available. He didn't just write about free market anarchism. Later on, he retreated a bit from free market anarchism and thought, well, no. But he came to worry about public goods and so thought, well, maybe you need individual municipalities to have a monopoly contract, which then is renewable, so that rather than having competing firms in the same area, you'd have a firm sign up, you know, the way cable companies do. The municipality picks this security company to do the security for this town for like a 2-year contract, and then it's renewable by public vote and so forth. So he retreated to a less anarchistic position, but still fairly radical by most standards. But he wrote on a lot of other stuff, too. I mean, he wrote zillions and zillions of books on all kinds of topics. He also did a lot of travel writing. He traveled all over the world, including several times to the U.S., and wrote about that. He was very well known in his day. His books were reviewed by people like Henry James and Lord Acton and Thorsten Veblen and so forth. Then below him, I name a couple of other people who, with somewhat similar views that may have been influenced by him. One of them is Anselm Bellegarigue, who, as he puts it, favors substituting business for politics. And his he doesn't seem to have had competing security firms in mind. He seems likely to have thought of having, you know, just a monopoly firm, but it wouldn't be a coercive monopoly. It has to be one that people consent to. And so people can sign up and consent to this one or not. But he doesn't seem to have considered the question, what about, you know, what if you don't want to sign up with this one, but you still want to sign up with something, could you sign up with an alternative? That question doesn't seem quite to have occurred to him. But nevertheless, he is, you know, fairly radical, and he explicitly identifies himself as an anarchist. Then Paul-Émile Dupuis is someone who has a kind of watered-down version of Molinari's view. And Dupuis is almost certainly influenced by Molinari, and they were both Belgian free market economists and were likely to have known each other. Dupuis' view is you should have a monopoly government, but it will offer various different services. And you can, so if it's a particular style of government you like, it'll offer different governmental services to different clients. So that if you want, so if you want to pay a lot of taxes and have a very, lots of government services, you sign up for that. You sign up for the premium service. If you just want your rights protected and you want low taxes, you sign up for the basic service. And he says you can even sign up for anarchy if you want, though he doesn't say exactly how that one works. But anyway, he seems to have been the one who coined the term panarchy, which people sometimes use today. Then at the same time in England, we get Herbert Spencer, who seems to have been influenced indirectly by the Saint-Saur group. I don't think he ever read any of them, but he borrowed some of their terminology, probably indirectly, perhaps through John Stuart Mill, who had read them. Spencer, in turn, ended up being a big influence on Molinari. Spencer develops a strong theory of spontaneous order. He develops the famous law of equal freedom. Each person should be free to do whatever they want, so long as they don't infringe the like freedom of others to do what they want. Which is sort of an early version of the non-aggression principle, strong anti-imperialist. Nowadays, Spencer is most famous for something he never said. If you look in textbooks, you'll find that that Spencer said that charity is wrong because it prevents the poor and sickly from dying off. And we should want the weaker people to die off in order to improve the human race. He never said that. In fact, he strenuously denied it over and over and over and over again. Now, he does have several passages where he says, the process by which the poor and sickly die off is actually a good thing because it improves the species. But then in each case, immediately after that, he goes on to say, from this you might think that it would be a good thing not to give charity, but you would be wrong. Because the benefit produced through charity is actually greater than the benefit produced by the benefit you get from saving the poor and weak is actually greater than the other benefit you get from dying off. I mean, whether you buy all the details of his argument or not, he clearly says this. And he always says it, within a couple of sentences after saying the other thing. So it really seems like either incredible sloppiness or dishonesty not to get this. Now, of course, he was against government-funded charity. And he also thought that charity should focus on making people self-reliant rather than on making them more dependent. But still, not only was he not against charity, but he thought there was a moral duty to give to charity. There were a lot of people who were strongly influenced by Spencer, even if they didn't necessarily buy everything he said. They were close enough that they can be called Spencerians. In America, you get William Graham Sumner, coined the idea of the forgotten man. The forgotten man is the person who has to pay. When government decides to give a benefit to A, the forgotten man is the guy who has to pay for it. So in some ways, it's like, Bastiat's What is Seen and What is Not Seen. Sumner also has this great anti-war essay called The Conquest of the United States by Spain, which he argues during the Spanish-American War that even though America won the war in the military sense, by doing so, they became more fully an imperialist power, and so in a sense were conquered by Spain in the sense that they adopted the Spanish imperialist mindset. In Britain, we get Auberon Herbert and Wordsworth Donisthorpe, who are both Spencerians who in many ways are more radical than Spencer. In particular, Auberon Herbert becomes an advocate of voluntary taxation. He says we can arrange to... He never calls himself an anarchist. It's not clear whether he's quite an anarchist or not. But he becomes a fan of the idea that you could fund government services solely through voluntary fees. Donisthorpe eventually becomes a full-fledged anarchist. Don Slipp was also, coincidentally, one of the early developers of the motion picture camera. You can, if I found somewhere online, you can find the few seconds of London traffic that he, you know, that he filmed with his early camera, which was called like a kinesograph or some word like that. Okay, then over in America, you get the individualist anarchists. Most of these guys were proponents of a labor theory of value and often a fairly primitive version of a fairly unsophisticated version of the labor theory of value. At that, and some of them took this to be an ethical imperative too, and thought that it was immoral to sell something for more than it had cost you to make it. You might wonder why you would ever sell anything then. But nevertheless, they were very strong against government involvement in this issue. They thought this should be a purely voluntary thing, and that it would be. Although they were morally opposed to profit, they thought that it would be even worse to coercively interfere with profit. Let people freely do whatever they want, and then you can try and persuade them through moral suasion to adopt this principle. So they were pretty thoroughly going free marketers. Josiah Warren published what's called the first anarchist periodical. And I said there's always disputed exactly what counts as first, but at least he's got a pretty good claim to have the first anarchist periodical. And he and his disciple Stephen Pearl Andrews actually founded some anarchist communities in the U.S., one in Ohio, one in New York State. Another guy in this tradition is Lysander Spooner. Spooner's critique of the Constitution is pretty well known in libertarian circles. He criticizes it on the grounds that no one ever consented to it. His other works are not as widely known, but they are also worth reading. He developed a theory of constitutional interpretation before he decided the Constitution was just hopeless. For a while, he was a fan of it, but argued for interpreting it in a very libertarian way, and has a lot of interesting stuff to say there. He was an abolitionist. You know, people often think that he must have been a Confederate sympathizer because of the way he attacks Lincoln and the Union in the Constitution of No Authority. But in fact, he not only was an abolitionist, he was a sympathizer with John Brown, and had actually was actually one of the supporters of Brown. And he thought that the best way to achieve and Venice was to go sneak in and arm all the slaves and get them to rebel, which is not a typical pro-Confederate position. He founded his own mail company. In fact, one of his first constitutional writings is about the unconstitutionality of the ban on private competing mail. And actually, he was able to charge lower prices than the government did, so they shut him down. So it was worth remembering him now that we have the mail service is in the U.S. is cutting itself back, threatening to cancel Saturday delivery and so forth, but still not allowing anyone to compete with them. We might need Spooner again. One of the most influential guys was Benjamin Tucker, who founded a periodical called Liberty, and a lot of the major individualist anarchists in America wrote for it. Also, people like Auburn Herbert and Wordsworth Donisthorpe over in Britain. There was cross fertilization between the Spencerians and the Tuckerites, even though they disagreed on some things. Tucker called himself a socialist, but by that he meant that he thought that the existing control of capital was the result of systematic government privilege, and that worker empowerment would be the result of a free market. Unlike Warren and Andrews, he, at least in his later years, didn't think that that cost the limit of price was a moral imperative. Instead, he just thought that the competition would tend to reduce price to cost once you got rid of government privilege. Though what he doesn't seem to have seen is the Austrian idea that cost itself isn't a fixed thing. How much it costs to produce something isn't a fixed thing, because that also depends on the prices of the goods, which ultimately go back to subjective valuation. Tucker also developed an idea of competing firms to replace government, and it's difficult to say whether he knew about Molinari or not. I mean, he knew about Molinari later at some point, but by the time he knew about Molinari, Molinari was no longer stressing so much the competing firms, although Molinari hadn't quite retracted it yet either. Tucker credits lots of people for influencing. I mean, he never mentions Molinari, so he mentions Spencer, but he doesn't mention Molinari, so that's possible reason for thinking he wasn't influenced, that he came up with it independently. On the other hand, Tucker did read French and kept up with a lot of French contemporary literature, both fiction and nonfiction, and translated a lot of stuff. So he's more likely than the average American anarchist to have read Molinari, so it's hard to say. Okay, we've got about 4 minutes for questions. Yes.
Hayek's book, The Constitution of Liberty, there's a chapter where he makes mention of the distinctions of the brands of variants of French liberalism and British liberalism. And while there were plenty of French classical liberals adhering to our understanding of liberty, he credits a lot of the so-called French liberals later on, attributing the title to such as Robespierre and Rousseau as being the people to more or less hijack and, I'd say, deliberately distort the term.
Hayek has this view that most of the French liberals were really of a more statist, sort of constructivist, rationalist hue. He has an article called Liberalism True and False, which is in Individualism and Economic Order. I think it's like the first essay in there. Where he says he wants to contrast the true English liberalism with the false French liberalism. I tend to agree with Rothbard and with Ralph Rako that this is this tends to be distortion. I mean, it's certainly true that Rousseau and Robespierre have a lot of problems, but then no one ever thought they were classical liberals anyway. Maybe someone probably thought that, but anyway, in his book, Rako has a recent book. Which I'm sure is probably in there in the bookstore. I forget the title. Classical Liberalism in the Austrian School. And he has a couple of chapters on French liberalism there where he takes issue with Hayek. And then also Rothbard has a long section on French liberalism in the history of economic thought. I think that Hayek exaggerates. It's really true. You can find individual figures that will substantiate Hayek's view, but I think anyone that thinks that Edmund Burke is a better libertarian than most of these French guys is something wrong there. I actually had a recent debate with Matt Zielinski on this. It's one of the things I intended to put down in the reading, and I didn't. Liberty Fund has a feature they call Liberty Matters. See, it's a pun. Where they have various exchanges on things. And I was recently involved in a panel, online panel there, with Matt Zielinski, David Friedman, and David Hart about Molinari and French liberalism more generally. So if you do a search for that, you can see my making the case against Hayek's division and Matt Zielinski defending it somewhat. Yes.
Were you considering putting Wolfgang von Goethe on this list, or do you not really consider him to be that well known?
Well, he's fairly well known. I don't think he's fairly well known as a free marketer, because the people who are interested in him tend not to be interested in the free market stuff. But, I mean, you know, I could have made this list much longer, and there are lots of other people on here. I mean, there are almost no Germans on here, and that's, you know, there are people in the German tradition. Actually, one of the few Germans on here is John Henry McKay, who I put down as an American anarchist because he was a follower of Tucker. But despite his name and despite his being in the American anarchist section, he was actually German. Yeah. I'm not inclined to think it's affected that much, because you can find nominalists and realists on both sides of... I mean, you can find both nominalists and realists in that tradition. And the medieval dispute between nominalists and realists was fairly nuanced. I mean, the nominalists always said, well, universals aren't real, but they have a foundation in reality. And the realists tended to say, universals are real, but they're real as universal only in the mind, and they exist as particular only in the world, which means that the two views are really much more similar than sort of the extreme versions of nominalism and realism that we tend to think of as the textbook caricature. So I think that the distinction between most of the nominalists and realists in the Middle Ages, you know, like take a realist like Aquinas and a nominalist like Abelard. Their views are very, very close to each other. It's just a very slight tweak that gets one away from the other. Okay, time for one more? Yes.
Did the American anarchists you mentioned, did they share the right-wing social conservatism which characterized the later American libertarian movement?
Yeah, most of them were... most of them were, for example, strong feminists. And, they were not social conservatives by and large. They were, they were culturally lefty on the whole. Okay, I think that's all the time we've got. Thank you.